Perhaps the most fascinating thing in nature is the human mind. We are material beings, of course, but we also think, feel, reason, and understand. How is it that the mind is related to the body? Our guest today is Dr. Edward Fazer on Mind Matters.
Welcome to Mind Matters News, where artificial and natural intelligence meet head on. Here's your host, Robert J. Marks.
This is Dr. Michael Eggner, and I am guest hosting today. I am a professor of neurosurgery at Stony Brook Medical School in New York. Our guest today is Dr. Edward Fazer, who is a philosopher who has written extensively on the mind and on the relationship of the mind to the body, and he has a book called Aristotle's Revenge, which is just out, and it is my privilege to have him as a guest today. Dr. Fazer, Roger Scruton, who's also one of my favorite philosophers, wrote one time that neuroscience is a vast collection of answers with no memory of the questions. What did he mean by that?
Well, that's like a lot of Scruton quotes. That's a great quote. I don't know the whole entire context or source of that that quote, but I imagine that what he was getting at is that we approach the question of the nature of the mind and the study of the human mind from a point of view that, from the Aristotelian perspective, which is the perspective I represent, wants to answer four sorts of questions about the nature of the mind, just as it would the nature of any other thing. We want to know the what Aristotle would call the formal cause of a thing, namely its nature or essence. We want to know the material cause of a thing, the stuff out of which it's made, the stuff that takes on that nature or essence. We want to know the efficient cause of a thing, which is what brought it into being, what brought it into existence, or the mechanisms by which it operates. And we want to know the final cause of a thing, the end or goal that it points to. And when we're explaining any natural phenomenon for Aristotle, we want to examine these four aspects of a complete explanation: its formal, material, efficient, and final causes. And that's as true of the human mind as it is of anything else. And part of the problem with contemporary neuroscience is it often, or I should say, let's say, popularizations of contemporary neuroscience. And in particular, what neuroscientists say when they start trying to draw philosophical lessons from neuroscience. The problem with a lot of what they say is they essentially focus on what Aristotle would call material causes and efficient causes, what the mechanisms are by which the mind operates, particularly the physical mechanisms and the efficient causes. But they ignore the idea of formal cause, and they ignore the idea of final cause, ends, goals, or purposes, and so forth. And so, you know, they examine the human mind in something like the way that a chemist would examine a painting. If a chemist were examining the Mona Lisa, he might tell you about the chemical structure of the pigments, the chemical structure of the paint, the canvas, and so forth. But if you confine your description to that alone, you're certainly not getting everything that there is to know about the painting, and you're not describing the most important things about the painting, namely the meaning of the painting and the object, the person who's represented by it, and so forth. And in the same way, contemporary neuroscientific descriptions of human nature often leave out, in effect, the person in the painting by focusing exclusively on physical mechanisms. And I imagine that that's part of what Scruton had in mind, whether or not he would put it in exactly those Aristotelian terms.
How is it that human beings are able to reason, to use logic, and to think abstractly? Neuroscientists presuppose that our minds are entirely material things. But do you think it's possible to have abstract thought that has an entirely material basis?
No, I don't think it is. And the reason why is one that, you know, spelling it out in detail would take us into philosophical technicalities that are maybe beyond the scope of our discussion. But I could briefly make a couple points here, which Aristotelians and Thomists, followers of Thomas Aquinas, often make. One of the points is that when we grasp abstract ideas, for example, take an example I often like to use. We have the general or abstract idea of triangularity, of being a triangle. And it's one that we convey in words like, in the words of a definition, like a triangle is a closed plane figure with three straight sides. Okay. Well, when we grasp that that nature, that former pattern of being a triangle, we're grasping something that's totally abstract. it applies to every single triangle that has existed, does exist, will exist, or for that matter, could exist, whether it's a triangle drawn in ink, whether it's a triangle drawn in sand on at the beach, whether it's a triangle you construct by putting three sticks together, whether it's a triangle on the side of a pyramid or that forms a dinner bell or what have you. The idea or concept is entirely abstract. And part of the problem with identifying that with something going on in the brain is that anything that's taking place in a material object, like let's say a symbol or a material representation encoded in a neural firing pattern in the brain, say, anything like that is always concrete or specific or individual, as opposed to abstract or completely general, the way that a concept is. So, for example, suppose someone were to say, and no one would say this, this is obviously too crude a model, but this would be kind of the best case scenario for identifying a concept with something going on in the brain. Suppose somebody said that whenever we think about triangles in the abstract, whenever we entertain the abstract concept of a triangle, there's a firing pattern in the neurons that make up the brain that traces out a triangular shape, right? Of course, that's not what happens. But suppose it did happen. I mean, that would be sort of the best case scenario where you'd have something in the brain that would correspond to triangularity. The problem with identifying the concept of triangularity with that particular pattern is that particular pattern would itself just be one specific individual triangle among others. It would be, say, a roughly grayish, whitish, reddish, non-right triangle within a particular human brain, which differs, of course, in its very nature from triangularity in the abstract or triangularity in general. So there's a kind of mismatch between concepts or ideas on the one hand, which are abstract or completely general, and on the other hand, physical symbols and other physical or material representations, which are always concrete, specific, and individual. And you find that attempts to reduce abstract thought to matter always suffer from this sort of problem, this sort of fallacy, as they confuse what's abstract and general with what's concrete and individual.
It's very common nowadays that neuroscientists refer to the mind as a kind of computation. Is thinking, for example, abstract thought, is it a kind of computation? And a related question, do you think that computers can think?
I think that computers cannot think if all they're doing is what computers in the modern sense do, which is running algorithms, manipulating symbols according to the rules of an algorithm. And one way to take that view, one reason to take that view or to see why that view is correct, is one suggested by an argument presented by the contemporary philosopher John Searle, who's retired now but used to teach at Berkeley. Searle is well known for what's called the Chinese room argument against the idea of artificial intelligence, but the argument that I have in mind is not actually that argument. It's an argument that he presented about 10 years after the Chinese room argument presented in the early 90s. And Searle's point is basically this, that a computer is of its very nature, computers as we understand them today, on the model of Turing machines, say, you know, named for Alan Turing, machines that manipulate symbols according to the rules of an algorithm. Computers are essentially a kind of artifact. They are in this respect like watches or ping pong tables or television sets or airplanes or chairs. They're not naturally occurring kinds of thing. Science, by contrast, physical science, physics and chemistry and biology, for example, are, by contrast, precisely in the business of studying and discovering the properties of natural objects, natural substances. So think about the following sort of example. There is an objective fact of the matter, one that we can learn by doing physics and chemistry, about what it is to be stone, or what it is to be water, or what it is to be gold, or what it is to be lead. We do chemistry, we do physics, we discover the properties of those substances, which exist in a kind of mind-independent way. They're already out there, as it were, waiting to be discovered by us, what the chemical facts are, what the physical facts are about those substances. But there is no objective, observer-independent, or mind-independent fact of the matter about what it is to be a chair, say, or what it is to be a watch. Those are human artifacts. Those things are what they are only relative to human interests, only relative to human observers. So whereas we could discover a new kind of stone or a new kind of metal, say, in nature, existing out there before any human beings ever come along, we could never discover sort of existing already out there in nature and apart from any human observers, a chair that had come about through natural processes, say, because a chair of its very nature is something that exists only relative to certain human purposes and human goals, like sitting down. Even if we went into some forest where, as far as we knew, no human being had ever set foot before, and we found some stone object that had a vaguely chair-like shape, it wouldn't really be a chair until somebody comes along and decides to use it as a chair. It would merely be something that looked like a chair. So a chair is not a naturally occurring kind of object, and chairs as such are therefore not objects of study in physical science, in physics or chemistry, say. Now, Searle's point is that computers have exactly the same sort of status as a chair or a watch or a television set does. There's nothing that occurs objectively and apart from human purposes in the natural order of things that counts as a computer. Something counts as a computer. It counts as something that's manipulating symbols and running through the stages of an algorithm or running software only relative to human purposes and human interests. The computers that we're most familiar with, after all, were made by human beings. They didn't grow on trees. They were constructed by human designers with a certain purpose. And if that's the case, then it really makes no sense to think of the human brain as literally a kind of computer. That's like thinking that if you found an object out in the middle of the forest that, because of wind and water erosion, had taken on a vaguely chair-like appearance, that it would literally be a chair. Well, it wouldn't be a chair. It would be something that we could decide to use as a chair, but it wouldn't all on its own be a chair. Chairs exist only relative to human purposes. And in the same way, computers exist only relative to human purposes. So for that reason, Searle argues, and I think he's entirely right about this, it makes no sense to try to explain the human mind by reference to the idea that the brain is a kind of computer, because nothing counts as a computer in the first place, including the human brain, unless there are already human minds around to interpret things as computers. So the computer model of the mind, the idea that the human mind is a kind of software, it really gets the cart before the horse. You have to explain computers by reference to minds, not vice versa.
It's very common in the media today to read of some new discovery that someone will do an MRI scan of the brain and find a particular region of the brain that lights up when a person has a certain thought or so on. And that phenomenon in the news has been called neurobabble. What is neurobabble, and does it make sense or not?
Neurobabble is, and I can't remember if it was Raymond Tallis or Tyler Burge, a couple contemporary philosophers who first came up with that phrase. But neurobabble, I guess you could define as the tendency to leap to philosophical conclusions from neuroscientific premises without realizing that you're essentially reading the philosophical conclusions into the neuroscience before you pull them back out again. It's really a kind of fallacy, kind of what philosophers would call a category mistake. And so you get neuroscientists who make all sorts of bold and even outrageous philosophical claims on the basis of alleged findings of neuroscience. You get them denying the existence of free will or denying, say, that that our introspection of our own consciousness is really reliable, or in any number of other things based on the alleged findings of neuroscience. Now, I should immediately qualify that by saying that I don't think that neuroscientists in general are necessarily guilty of that. But when you find neuroscientists who write, say, works of pop science, or you find people who aren't neuroscientists, but they're writing in some other field, either they're philosophers or they are scientists of some other kind, they're biologists or physicists, or maybe they're just public intellectuals who often make bold philosophical claims in the name of neuroscience, they would be guilty of that sort of fallacy. But typically, the arguments rest on assumptions that are not really following from the neuroscientific evidence itself, but rather, as I say, they're philosophical assumptions that are made on entirely independent grounds and then read into the neuroscience before they're read back out again. So if you want, I can give you an example of how this goes. So a claim that's often made is that that neuroscience has somehow undermined the existence of free will. And that experiments like those famously associated with the neuroscientist and experimental psychologist Benjamin Libet somehow show this, where the claim is that Libet allegedly showed that, you know, by the study of certain subjects in a famous experiment that he did, that the neurological activity that generates our behavior occurs slightly before, a split second, fraction of a second before the time that the conscious choice is made. So the claim is that, Libet's experiments show that free choices are not really what determine what we do. It's actually totally unconscious behavior in our nervous systems that determines what we do. So that free will is a kind of illusion. Okay, this is an argument you often hear, and it's popularized by various pop writers on the subject of neuroscience. Okay, but there are a number of problems with this sort of argument, and this is something that I actually discuss at least briefly in Aristotle's Revenge, by the way, and I've talked about it elsewhere. One problem with it is that how exactly we interpret the neurological phenomena that Libet identified is itself a philosophical matter. I mean, all we have there in the actual neuroscientific evidence is certain neural processes occurring, and they're followed by certain kinds of behavior. In Libet's examples, it had to do with the flexing of a wrist, okay? And a split second after this particular neurological phenomenon that he's measuring occurs, we have people report, I was consciously aware then of my urge to flex the wrist and so forth. But for one thing, whether that the neurological phenomena that he's measuring there, whether that corresponds to, say, an unconscious intention to flex one's wrist, or whether it corresponds instead to, say, merely imagining the possibility of flexing one's wrist, or merely considering whether or not to flex one's wrist before deciding to do it, or one of several other possible interpretations, Libet doesn't consider that question. He doesn't consider, again, why exactly we should interpret the neurological phenomena that he's measuring as somehow all by itself amounting to an unconscious decision to flex the wrist, as opposed to one of these other possible interpretations. He simply assumes that that's the right way to interpret it. For all he's shown, the neurological phenomena that he's measuring corresponds merely to the subject entertaining the possibility of flexing the wrist before going on actually to decide to flex it, in which case the actual decision is indeed what, after all, causes the piece of behavior in question. Another problem with this whole argument that Libet and others influenced by him give is that the kind of example he chose to study is highly idiosyncratic. He asked subjects to sort of sit there, and he said, okay, I want you to wait until you have an urge to flex your wrist. And then when you when this urge sort of arises within you, go ahead and register that you have the urge, and then go ahead and flex the wrist, as if that's a model for how free choice works in general. But of course, most of the actions that we think of as free actions are not like that at all. We don't, when we act freely, it's typically not this sort of thing where we wait passively for some urge to well up within us. Rather, we're doing something active rather than passive. We're thinking through different possible courses of action and then finally deciding on one rather than the other, rather than waiting for urges to well up in us and so forth. In fact, the sort of case where we exhibit some behavior because of some urge that wells up within us is actually the kind of case we typically think of as an unfree sort of behavior. Like when we feel an urge to sneeze, say, and when this urge strikes us, we find ourselves sneezing. Well, nobody thinks of that as an action that was produced by free will. We think of that rather as a kind of behavior that was not a product of free will. And yet that's the kind of behavior, namely producing behavior as a result of some urge that just strikes us that we're passively waiting for. That's the kind of behavior that Libet takes to be a model for all of free action. So it's a rather unrepresentative sample, to say the very least. So these are some of the philosophical problems that arise for these attempts to show that neuroscience somehow undermines belief in free will. These arguments never really rest on neuroscience by itself. They rest on certain philosophical assumptions that are read into the neuroscience, and they're philosophical assumptions that are typically not defended, but just taken for granted, and that are highly problematic.
I completely agree. And I thank you, Ed, for joining us. This has been Ed Fezzer, a prolific author and philosopher. And his latest book is Aristotle's Revenge, which is a superb book. And I thank Dr. Fezzer again for joining us on Mind Matters News. Thank you.
This has been Mind Matters News with your host, Robert J. Marks. Explore more at mindmatters.ai. That's mindmatters.ai. Mind Matters News is directed and edited by Austin Egbert. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the speakers. Mind Matters News is produced and copyrighted by the Walter Bradley Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence at Discovery Institute.